Benjamin Reinhart is an engineer, researcher, and writer. He is currently the CEO of Speculative Technologies, a nonprofit organization that runs coordinated research programs focused on new materials and advanced manufacturing processes. Ben, welcome to the Splinter.
Thank you for having me.
So Ben, you've spent a lot of time thinking about and writing about the nature of innovation, and more specifically, the kinds of institutions in our society that enable frontier science and technology at different stages in the continuum. So from ideation to proof of concept to commercialization. And ultimately, you arrived at the conclusion that the innovation ecosystem is incomplete, writing that, quote, impactful work is often too researchy for startups, too engineering heavy for academia, and too weird for governments. So I'd like to start there and get all our listeners on the same page. What does today's institutional landscape look like? What are we doing well, and what could we be doing better?
Oh boy. All right. Well, I will try to compress this, but so imagine, maybe let's start, like, imagine you are a young, ambitious technical person and you want to do something new. What options do you have before you? Well, you could go into academia, which is, I think I use it in this broad term that encompasses most of the work that's done at universities, but also other places. And the sort of primary identifier is that academia is the place where you are incentivized to write papers. Like that is sort of the unit of currency. So you could do that. That would involve going to grad school, probably doing a postdoc, attempting to get a professor position. And all those things. Or you could say, that is not for me. I want to start a startup. And the sort of startups are defined by the incentive to primarily grow quickly with the hypothesis that in the future, you will make a lot of money. So the incentives there, instead of writing papers, is making money and really raising money and growing. You could go and work at a corporate research lab. They still exist. You could work at Microsoft Research or Google Brain, or one of the many labs in large companies. And there, the incentives are a little bit fuzzier, but it's kind of to keep the projects alive and trickle things up to the public shareholders usually. And then there's sort of like, those would be the primary ones. There are so sort of like a long tail of other things. There are government research labs, which kind of have some flavors of academia and some flavors of corporate research, but your boss is the government. But I would sort of describe those as the three major nodes or incentive systems that people have going for them. Obviously it's extremely nebulous. There aren't hard boundaries. And like things the system does well is, I think once it becomes clear, once something gets sort of anchored in the public mind as potentially really impactful, the system does a pretty good job of like pouring money into it. So we can see things like AI or quantum computing, I think are two that right now there's like the system is doing pretty well for. Obviously there's things in AI and things in quantum computing that are not well supported. I think the system also does pretty well at encouraging research, really sort of like exploring weird corners of existing paradigms of knowledge. And so what I mean by that is like the system is pretty good at sort of like poking at things like string theory. Like there's this paradigm of knowledge and it's like, oh, we want to discover like other things related to that. The system is pretty good at supporting that. Where it's weak is in situations that require that sort of like step outside of the incentive systems of these major institutions. And so that's things where maybe you need to do like kind of grungy engineering, but with a very speculative goal, or situations where you want to do some kind of discovery oriented thing, but it just sounds utterly crazy compared to the current scientific paradigms. There's sort of a long list of things, and maybe it's you can't really describe all of them, because sort of by definition, the stuff that the system doesn't support well doesn't even have a name yet. Mm-hmm. So how's that for an overview of the state of play?
Fantastic. I loved it. I wanted to ask before we continued, has there always been a sort of gap in the innovation pipeline, or is it a more modern phenomenon?
Oh yeah. There always has been a gap, and I would argue that there always will be gaps. The gaps will change. And I think that's just the nature of the system, right? Like, it's this dynamic changing system. If I can insert my opinion, is like, what we need to do is like have like meta systems to be able to fill in gaps more quickly, because they will always crop up.
Well, you proposed a new kind of institution to help complete the picture. One based on the United States is DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, famous for having developed a bunch of cutting edge technologies like ARPANET, GPS, stealth technology, unmanned aerial vehicles, and more recently, the DARPA Grand Challenge that was focused on autonomous vehicles. Though you do recommend one significant change, which is privatizing the endeavor. So what is it about DARPA as an organization that makes it so unique and so worthy of emulation? And why is private funding preferable to government sponsorship?
So the thing that I've realized about DARPA is that And this is like, since I wrote that piece about how DARPA works, I think like this meta realization that it's not any specific procedure, but what DARPA does is it finds really amazing people and gives them this extremely urgent sandbox to execute on these really ambitious ideas. And it gives them sort of the leeway to execute on those ideas in the way that's best for that idea, right? And so that could be being really opinionated and saying, like, this group over here needs to do this, this group over here needs to do this, this group over here needs to do this. You all need to coordinate together and like hit this deadline and these milestones. But that can also, like, and that's kind of how ARPANET happened. But it could also be something where it's, here's a vision. Anybody who sort of shares in this vision, come to me, propose things, I'll give you money and just like let you get off to the races. And that's really what like JCR Licklider did with personal computing, right? And it's at first glance, those two MOs look completely different, but the thing that unites them is that it's really giving what I would call like research leaders the agency to go execute on that well. So that's I think, you know, you can go into much more detail about how you do that and how DARPA has done that in the past. And the reason that, and it's not, so I'm not arguing that that should not be done in the government, but I think that doing it in the government does leave a gap, because at the end of the day, there's this fundamental tension around government research, which is that on the one hand, as citizens in a democracy who are paying taxes, we want the government to spend our money responsibly, right? Like I want that. At the same time, to do really good research, you need to be a little bit irresponsible. And so any government research organization is going to be walking this fine line between needing to justify itself and doing really groundbreaking things. And so obviously like private organizations also need to justify themselves to a different set of people, but that set of people can be different. And so you will have different constraints on private organizations. And so that's why I think that having that, these private organizations doing crazy stuff is important as well.
On the topic of creating value, there's a big difference between creating value and capturing value. So in your opinion, is it important that these private ARPAs be structured to allow for the innovators operating within them to be rewarded for the value that they bring into the world? Are patents an important part of the mix? Or should these institutions be dedicated to working on public goods?
I mean, I would argue the latter, simply because, many people disagree with me, but I think that the sort of market in for-profit organizations is pretty efficient. Like, a private ARPA that is trying to capture the value that it creates is just a startup incubator, right? Mm. And like, startup incubators do a lot of good work, but I think that there's just a lot of work that you won't do if you look at it from the beginning and you say, like, will this make a good startup? Will I be able to capture the value either through IP or through equity? And so that's why I think there's inherently this public goods aspect of these things. And then in terms of patents, I think as you will be very annoying, the answer is always it depends. I think that patents are really good for a subset of technology where there's a very tight correspondence between a sort of a discovery or work in a lab and a single discovery and a product. So in therapeutics, patents are very effective because you can sort of say, because they do allow for that sort of backwards transmission of profit-seeking behavior to research, where you can say, like, look, we know that if we discover this thing in the lab, we will be able to create a therapeutic, and there's this really clear market for fighting cancer, and we'll be able to get this much money because we know that the insurance companies will pay for it. And so you can sort of back-propagate that all the way to fund the research. Whereas many technologies don't have that property, and in reality, they are systems. And if you have everybody try to sort of get their piece of the pie from the IP in that system, the system won't get built. And that's what you see over and over again. So I think in many situations, the patent in its current form no longer serves the purpose of motivating innovation. Because at the end of the day, that was its purpose. Like, a patent is a thing that we made up to try to encourage people to invent things, and I don't think that it serves that purpose in many situations.
In February of this year, you announced the creation of a private ARPA of your own called Speculative Technologies. In an essay announcing the organization, you wrote that its mission is to create an abundant, wonder-filled future by unlocking powerful materials and manufacturing technologies that don't have a home in other institutions. And in a previous interview, you explained why you chose to make this your goal, saying that, quote, the biggest social and economic effects of technologies are all second-order effects, and the technologies most likely to create second-order effects are advanced materials and new manufacturing processes. What exactly do you mean by second-order effect? And what specific materials and manufacturing research programs have you identified as potentially offering the best ROI in that respect?
So by second order effects, I mean that the technologies have an effect that was not the reason that people built or started using the technologies. There's too many examples to count. The sort of my go-tos are one, pointing out that a few decades ago, the biggest existential risk to humanity in people's minds was overpopulation. And, maybe I'll date myself by saying this, but like right now, people are very worried about the existential risk from AI. The same sort of fervor of concern was directed at overpopulation. And now we don't really talk about it that much. And arguably a large part of that is because we got good enough at making artificial fertilizer through things like the Haber-Bosch process and got good enough at creating new kinds of crops through the Green Revolution that we can create enough food to feed the planet. But like the original intention of building the Haber-Bosch process and creating artificial nitrates was not to solve overpopulation. It was to provide food for Germany during World War One. And so the second order effect of pushing that process forward was reducing the existential risk from overpopulation. Effectively, electricity saved the whales through second order effect, in the sense that, you know, electricity was not invented to save the whales. But the reason that we stopped hunting whales for whale oil was because we could light our houses with electric light bulbs instead of whale oil lamps. And so that's what I mean by a second order effect. There was a second part of that question that I have forgotten.
Yeah. So it's why, what specific materials and manufacturing research programs have you identified to like capture the value of second order effects?
Well, the tricky thing about second order effects is that they are extremely hard to predict. So I can tell you what programs were running at Speculative Technologies, but I can't say, like, almost by definition, I can't say how they're going to have these second order effects. So we've identified things that are sort of like big if true. Some examples of programs that we're working on are programs to turn carbon dioxide into complex carbon-based molecules that currently we get from petroleum. The sort of like big if true piece is one kind of like the first order effect that we need to, if we're going to reduce our dependence on petroleum, we need to find ways of making all the things that normally we make from petroleum in addition to fuels. But then the second order effect is like, hey, if we can figure out how to use the metabolites from cells in a chemical engineering scalable way, that sort of opens up an entirely new affordance for manufacturing chemicals. And like the hunch is like, oh, there like could be a bunch of big things that follow on to that like I can't even think of right now, right? So like that's kind of the speculation on the second order effect. Or we have another program that is looking at replicating the mechanisms that spiders use to make spider silk and other organisms use to make sort of really powerful materials that have properties that we can't even replicate synthetically. And again, it's this hunch that if we can create synthetic materials using this process where you actually like order the molecules on the molecular level before extruding them and then apply a time-varying stimulus to them to get tunable properties, we could open the door to materials that have wild new properties and like then and then hand wavy second order effect, right? So that's the kind of admittedly unsatisfying answer to that, but there's a reason we're called Speculative Technologies, so I will use that in my defense.
Indeed, great name. As you hinted at already, the success of the ARPA model rests on finding and empowering program managers to act as sort of mini CEOs of their internal research programs. These are the kinds of people that Vannevar Bush might have described as far-seeing, energetic individuals. But if the model depends on maximum flexibility, autonomy, and exploration, what does that mean for you as the CEO of Speculative Technologies? What's the appropriate management style or level of involvement for a CEO of mini CEOs?
Well, one, still figuring that out. Two, I think like if I were to like sum it up in one word, it's like trust, which is, I think, is kind of terrifying, right? Like you have to trust that what people like, you have to trust that the program leaders are doing the right thing, quote unquote, whatever that is. And so it means being very hands-off, tried to focus on, instead of like judging ideas or what they're going to do, just like making sure that it is as sort of precise as possible and making sure that I've done everything to like set them up for success that I can. So it's like, all right, like, are you thinking about how this is going to go move on beyond your program? Like, are you thinking about like, will this scale, right? Like, so just sort of making sure that they've thought about the things that I know are important to think about, but like sort of trusting that the solutions that they come up to with that and the way that they think we need to execute on it happens. And just like generally sort of being a bureaucracy umbrella, sort of saying like, all right, like I'll take care of the like outward facing bureaucracy stuff. You just go and execute on this as hard as you can. So that's currently how I'm doing it. I'm sure there's always ways to improve, but
it's become a sort of modern management truism that you can't manage what you don't measure. And yet very often, managers in professional environments find these metrics that they need to tabulate, you know, weekly or monthly to be incredibly stifling. What's the like appropriate level of scrutiny or milestones that you try to bring to programs? How do you walk that tightrope?
Again, like here, this is where it goes back to the program leaders, where I say, I sort of like would ask them. It's just like it's like, tell me what you think you're going to do, and then like let's sort of like touch base and make sure that happens. But yeah, I think like metrics are kind of like it's like a pendulum. And I think we've swung way too far towards the like everything must have metrics end of the pendulum. And I think like to the point of like going back to gaps in the ecosystem, I think that doing things that are hard to measure is one of those gaps. And so I certainly will nudge program leaders to say like to think about it, but if they can make a good argument that it's just like, this is hard to measure, then it's like, okay, cool. I trust you.
In some of your research, you've gone through and identified the properties or characteristics of the great industrial labs of the past. And you've sort of, drawn up a list of them. I found so many of them really interesting. So number one, industrial labs used to enable work on general purpose technology before it was specialized. Number two, industrial labs enable targeted piddling around, as we sort of discussed already, especially with equipment and collaborators who would not otherwise be accessible. But the one that really got me thinking was number seven. Industrial labs provided a first-class alternative to academia in which people could still participate in the scientific enterprise. And it kind of struck me that modern research institutions could be what startups are to large businesses. Where in his book, The Power Law, Sebastian Mallaby describes the history of venture capital, and he calls the first round of venture capital funding in the Valley back in the 50s and 60s liberation capital, in that it got these people out of these old stodgy institutions and got them working in fast-moving, innovative research, startup-y environments. Do you think a lot about how to position yourself as an alternative to academia? And if you do, what are the things you choose to emphasize as the CEO? Is it prestige? Is it funding? What do you think about?
So I think eventually, yes. Like that's sort of like a very ambitious thing. But I think it's what I emphasize. I guess like the way that I would put it is like if we don't like actually I de-emphasize both money and prestige, like so it's like this is for a very strange subset of people who like just want to see like amazing technology get into the world, right? And so it's like I say, okay, look, you're not going to make as much money as you would at a big company or at a startup, and you're not going to get the prestige that you would get from being in a university research lab, but what I can offer you is that, the one goal here is to get awesome technology out into the world, and I will sort of do everything in my power to enable you to do that. And like this is Right. Like, this is not what most people want. But there's a small subset of people who are interested in that. And it's like, those are the people that I'm trying to sort of create an alternate pathway for.
One final question on the importance of program managers. So we've identified that they are important. We've thought about how to attract them. But when it comes to identifying them, so you going out into the world trying to find the right person to head this new research program, has your research into the history of DARPA or other labs given you some features that you look for in a successful program manager?
I mean, all of these things are probably going to sound very tropey, but it's like people who are really obsessed with something, people who have a lot of drive. I think the things that I think maybe I can say that are less tropey are less from my research and more just from experience. There's something where people have like been in different worlds, in the sense that like they've like been in academia and they've been in a big company or a startup, and they sort of see, it's like this thing where like once you've been in different institutions, you can almost like see behind the curtain and see that like, oh, it's like possible you could sort of do whatever you want to make things happen. There's being good communicators is essential just because you're coordinating people. And so you need to like that communication is essential. There is sort of like the startup thing of like hustle and just like bias towards action is really important. And then there's this thing of like, what I like to describe as like being able to go up and down the ladder of abstraction. So being able to talk at an idea at like a very high level and say like, okay, like this is why this is important to a 5-year-old, but then being able to then go and like say like, okay, and like this is what the person at the bench is like needs to be thinking about. And it's like, okay, like let's talk about like, you know, how to tune your Kalman filter, right? So like sort of being able to do all those levels of abstraction and this like precision of thought that I think is very hard to do.
Shifting gears, I'd like to talk about the problem of stagnation more broadly, starting with energy. In October of last year, you wrote an essay for the journal Works in Progress titled Making Energy Too Cheap to Meter, in which you chronicled the shift in our cultural attitudes that took place after the Second World War, where we went from pursuing energy intensity to praising energy efficiency. It's a pretty radical shift. And looking back, it's one that had a pretty meaningful impact on our societies and our economies. You wrote that, quote, "The amount of energy we can access, how densely we can store it, and how quickly we can deploy it are the closest things to measures of our ability to manipulate the physical world. Energy creates a ceiling on what we can do. To cap our energy ambitions is to commit to permanent scarcity." Today, I think that most people interested in progress studies would generally agree with the importance of energy superabundance as a goal worth pursuing. So, Ben, if you can flip a switch and build a working fusion reactor, that's something you should probably do. But at the margin, I'm curious about the degree to which people agree on the relative importance of energy abundance, especially in relation to, for example, concerns over pollution or climate change. And Peter Thiel touched on this in a recent interview with Alex Epstein, saying that, quote, "The world consumes about 100 million barrels of oil a day. And if given a choice, do we go to 110 or do we go to 90? Surely the world in which we go to 110 is better than the world in which we go to 90. Do you agree with that? Like, how urgent is the need to ramp up energy intensity, not contingent on some major breakthrough, but in today's world with today's constraints?
On the margin, like, I think it depends on how, like there's a question of how, right? So like we could think of some extreme situations where on the margin we ramp up energy intensity that I think are bad. Like you could say something where it's like, okay, cool, like let's burn down the entire Amazon rainforest to power steam turbines, right? Like that is a on the margin way of increasing energy intensity that I don't agree with. Whereas on the flip side, if it's like let's do, I mean like, and there are people who disagree with me, but it's like, okay, other margin, like decreasing the overhead to building nuclear power plants, then I'm like, okay, like, definitely do that. And then there's like some transition point between those two where I stop agreeing, but I think that it is, I think that I probably think that it is more urgent than most people. Although on the flip side, like, most people where, right? Like most people in the US, yes. Probably most people in places where they don't have access to a lot of energy, like they're probably even more gung-ho than I am, right? So it depends on who you're, what population you're comparing me to.
Sticking with energy, I'm tempted to get your, to take your temperature, so to speak, on a couple of different innovations happening in the space. It strikes me that nuclear is definitely having a moment in the cultural zeitgeist, both in terms of fusion, but also fission in terms of small modular reactors. Geothermal energy is also picking up steam.
But
is there any subsector of that field that you are especially bullish on and would like to see more work in?
I think I would double click on, so one, I'm not an expert here, but I would definitely double click on geothermal, mostly because I think the downside risks are pretty small, and the thing to like, a lot of it is not a technology problem. A lot of it is just a regulatory problem. And so if it's like a thing where it's like, it's a regulatory thing and the downside risk is small, just like, I think we should definitely let people go a little bit more wild with that. And then I think, I have not run the numbers on it, but, I'm definitely like, biased towards space-based solar power just because it would be awesome. And so I think those are maybe the two that I think are underrated.
Vannevar Bush was the architect of America's scientific innovation pipeline throughout most of the 20th century, you can say. Recently, Stripe Press republished his memoir, Pieces of the Action, to which you contributed an awesome foreword. And in the foreword, you wrote that you came away, after having read the book, you came away from it having found the closest thing to a mentor that you can have with someone who's a stranger. What is it about Vannevar Bush that inspired such affection?
I mean, I think it was some combination of the fact that, like, in the book, it came through that he was just, like, this giant nerd. And I was like, oh, cool. I want to hang out with him. But then also it was, I think the way, and he was like this combination, he was like deeply technical, right? Like he was a professor at MIT. He was doing cutting edge work there on, you know, mechanical calculators, which ultimately were not the most useful thing. But he was deeply technical, but then also realized how important people were to pushing technology. And he kind of straddled all of these different worlds, right? Where he was hanging out with Frank Jewett at Bell Labs and working with the government and working with the academics, and sort of like actively creating new institutions. And so sort of like that combination, I was like, oh, cool. Like that is sort of what I would aspire to do.
In the growing canon of literature studying economic growth, the paper Are Ideas Getting Harder to Find, published in 2017 by Bloom, Jones, Renan, Webb, has become a major talking point. Their paper looked at the idea that economic growth depends fundamentally on people creating ideas, such that over time, the long-run growth depends on two variables, the number of researchers and their research productivity. And interestingly, in recent times, our economic growth has been somewhat flat, despite the massive increase in number of scientists working on different problems, highlighting a sharp decline in research productivity. Does that methodology and that thinking sound correct to you? Do you have an opinion about this paper?
So I'm not an economist. I don't think I'm not good at that way of thinking. So it's hard for me to weigh in. I think that the, I guess maybe where I'm coming from, it's like, I think that you can only go so far with like the level of abstraction at which they work, where they basically say like, ah, yes, all people doing R&D are effectively fungible, right? And this actually goes back to the beginning of the conversation where it's like, what institutions are those people working in? Like, what do we count as like R&D? Right. And so sure, like in aggregate, I guess maybe I would agree with their assertion that like in aggregate, the research writ broadly is less effective. But I think that the conclusions that they draw from that, I'm not sure that those are, yeah, I'm skeptical about what conclusions you can draw from it. That is just like, oh, like that, right? Because it's like, okay, like what is causing that decrease in productivity?
You've written that AI labs in particular have done a pretty decent job when compared to other sectors at promoting R&D and having quite successful output from their R&D programs. So people can think of DeepMind, Google Brain, OpenAI, of course. What is it about the nature of that problem, do you think, that makes it more tractable versus things like manufacturing or energy production? Is it something about the nature of software or something about the nature of big tech companies that somewhat gives them an edge? What's your thinking on that?
I mean, I think that it's the nature of what companies are getting monopoly profits, right? So right now, the companies that are really getting a lot of monopoly profits are tech companies, and these AI labs sort of feed directly into those companies' products. And so you can get this dynamic that you did have at Bell Labs, where you have what I would describe as like a money factory that is highly aligned with the R&D lab. It doesn't hurt, and so they can pour money into it. It doesn't hurt that software also takes much less time to go from R&D to a product, and so those labs can sort of deal with shorter time horizons for companies. So I think it's this just combination of properties of software that it is just very fast, it's very interesting, it's very easy for people who don't have traditional degrees to get into, right? Like there are some amazing AI researchers out there who do not have any sort of formal background. And then also properties of sort of tech companies, software companies, and the profits that they can command in the current economy.
Sort of blending these two topics of research, productivity, and AI, recent excitement on the topic of large language models has kind of reignited the interest in the Steve Jobsian idea of a bicycle for the mind. So building tools that can augment human thinking by surfacing interesting ideas, by summarizing content, or even by, you know, producing drafts. But of course, it's still unclear exactly what those tools will look like. In preparation for this call, I reached out to a new friend, Will Manidis, the founder and CEO of Science.io, to ask if he had any questions for you. And he submitted one very much along this line, asking the following: do you expect large language models to fundamentally increase the speed of scientific research, or will they simply help to expose how much of scientific literature is fake/unimportant? Are these tools sieves or accelerants?
I guess I would respond, why not both? I'm very hesitant to opine on LLMs just because there are many more informed people who have thought much more about it than I have. I realize this is annoying, but I'm going to continue to poke at like, what do we mean by science? I think that there are some areas of research that they will be drastic accelerants, and some areas of research that they will barely touch. If we think of, I guess maybe I have a stronger opinion that I think the idea that you're going to take the body of scientific literature and cram it into like fine tune an LLM on it and then be like, LLM, like, tell me new things about the world. I'm very skeptical about that because of a number of things, not the least being the amount of tacit knowledge that is involved in especially like physical science. And I think that the current LLM systems don't have the ability to get that. What will happen in, you know, a year, 4 years, I don't know. But I think that you'll, yeah, so that's where I'm like slightly more skeptical. But in terms of like what it will do further down the line, we'll see.
You've mentioned tacit knowledge. This is, you know, a longstanding problem in manufacturing, and you've thought a lot about manufacturing. What's the solution to something like that? Is it, you know, better documentation? Is it better training? Is it apprenticeships? How do we extract the tacit knowledge that people have, you know, sort of gained by osmosis through years of experience hands-on?
Oh, I think by definition, you can't. Like, that's what makes it tacit knowledge. Mm. If you could extract it, it wouldn't be tacit. I think what it is I would push the other way, which is making it easier for more people to sort of acquire it, and sort of like, instead of siloing away manufacturing, having it be more part of the organizations. Like, so going back to the AI labs, one of the advantages that they have is like the guys working at Google Brain are in the same organization. They go talk to the people working on Google Cloud infrastructure, right? Like, you could, and the people like running all of the like Google Google system infrastructure, right? And it's like, you could think of that as the like quote unquote manufacturing of software. And so having those feedback loops between the people doing research and the people doing the manufacturing is the thing that sort of like quote unquote like solves the problem. And one of the issues now is that people doing the manufacturing and people doing the research on the physical systems don't have that mechanism of interacting. This is not my idea. This is comes from Venki Narayanamurthy and Jeff Tsao, who have written a wonderful book on this called The Genesis of Technoscientific Revolutions, which is a mouthful but a very good book. And so that's what I would say, like, I don't think that we can. I mean, maybe there's something where like in the future you could just have cameras everywhere and have all the, you know, AI systems like munging all of that. I'm still vaguely skeptical of that, but possibly.
This brings me to my final question. In the post announcing the creation of Speculative Technologies, you wrote that, quote, institutions are more than just their outputs. They also embody cultures and values that spread if the institution is successful. One of the values you listed as aspirational was that of building an institution that, quote, walked the line between wonder and seriousness. As the CEO, how do you encourage your colleagues to live up to this aspiration? And if adopted more broadly across society, what positive impact do you think can come of it?
Oh, how do I encourage it? I don't know. It's like both... both in Slack, both posting science papers and then like cool sci-fi concepts. I don't know. It's like, I think both encouraging people like, oh yeah, like think bigger about this. Like, what could this be? But then also being like, did you think about like this? Like let's get more precise, right? So it's like doing that same thing and just kind of just, I don't know, living like, I don't know, lead by example, just trying to both be like, all right, like, let's talk about this, like really seriously, what's actually possible. But then also kind of say like, whoa, wouldn't it be cool if XYZ? I'm not sure I have a really like precise, rigorous way of doing that. And then I think if it was adopted more broadly, like the dream is that it's like on the one side, we encourage more people to pursue more weird, crazy things, but without forcing them to sort of hype it up. Like right now, you kind of need to be all in. This is going to be the best thing ever. It's going to be amazing. And if you say anything about like potential limitations or like things that you're running into, that gets shut down. So sort of like walking through the world with more of an attitude of like, wow, like that sounds like it won't work, but I think you should go for it anyway within a time box. And like, let's talk about like really pragmatically, like how do we see whether it might work, right? Like, so engaging seriously with weird ideas, as opposed to either like doing this like weird bipolar societal thing where we're either like, oh my God, this is the future, it's gonna change everything, or just like, that's dumb, like nobody should work on that, this is garbage. And so really sort of saying like, oh, like what if, is I would like to live in a world where there's more of that.
If people are inspired by what they heard today and would like to learn more or would like to contribute to the mission, is there any way that they can find you and contribute?
Yeah, I try to be very online, for better or for worse. Let's see, our website is just spec.tech, spec as in spectacles and tech as in technology. You can find me on Twitter, just Ben_Reinhardt. Those are probably the best ways to find out more, and then follow links from all of those places.
Well, Ben, thank you for doing what you do, and thank you for having been a guest on the Splinter Podcast.
Thank you for having me.